This is an interview with Brian Condon at his home in Port Pirie on the 10th of September 2018. Brian graduated from Roseworthy in 1946, diploma number 602. This interview by David Spencer is part of the Roseworthy Agricultural College Oral History Project. Brian, first of all, thank you for making the time available for this interview. It's nice to catch up with your reminiscences. It's been over 70 years since you were a student, but I gather you still have a vivid memory of many events during that time. So, Brian, you start where you like. You've got a lot of things to tell us.
Oh, well, David, perhaps we ought to talk about the preliminary before I got to Roseworthy. How do these things happen? I was at high school at the time, and I used to go down. We had a cordial factory, ice plant and dairy factory, and I used to go down there very regularly after school, and from about 10 years of age I worked there every holiday, Saturday, weekend, I'd be down the factory working. On this particular occasion was one afternoon after school. I went down to the factory and I went in the office, and there was Doug Anders was talking with my father. Now Doug, he finished up at the university. He was quite involved in quite a number of things down there. And we got talking. He said, "Oh, well, what are you doing when you leave school?" And we didn't have any definite plans, because at that stage, the Port Pirie High School only went up to the leaving standard, which meant to matriculate, you had to go down to Adelaide. So I had thoughts of going to Adelaide the following year to matriculate. And Doug said, just as we were talking, "Well, have you thought of doing something else?" He said, "Obviously you want to work in the butter factory when you're ready." He said, "Why don't you go to Roseworthy College?" And we said, "Well, what are you talking about? What's Roseworthy College?" Never, my father or myself, we'd never heard of it, didn't know what it was. And he explained how it was an agricultural college, and he thought it would be much better suited. And also, we thought it would be much better, as it would be more suited to what I wanted to do. So we got in touch with them. "Oh yeah, plenty of room." And we said, "All right, well, let's give this a go." So that's how it all started.
So, Brian, when was this? What year?
That was 1942.
So that was war time. So it was a fairly interesting time all around the place.
It was the height of the war, and very few people understand what wartime was like, because just in our normal living, everything was rationed. Everything was in short supply, because the industries all shut down, went to munitions and war work. So there was natural shortages and created shortages. For instance, we had butter rationing and also sugar, meat, and we all had coupons to get our supplies. Well, at the college, naturally, we had to go a bit short. We'd give all our ration tickets. They'd go into the cook, and he'd take so many, and we got along like that. So it was pretty hard times, and naturally that restricts the cook in what he can cook too. So our poor old Jack Osborne, he was the cook at the time there, and I tell you, we had some pretty airy-fairy meals.
So you started in the beginning of April 42. So what was your recollection of the first couple of months there?
Oh, well, I'll give you an idea of when we first started. That we got in the car, and as we had to go from Port Pirie here, across the main North Road, down through Clare, down to Roseworthy that way. And we arrived at the college, and I went and signed in, and then they said, "Oh, you're in room two." So we finally settled down into room two, and blow me down. Next thing, Bob Napstein, he arrived. And the thing is that I did know Bob before this. through family, and to think that we're at the same place at the same time was really a great surprise to me. Well, that was all okay. Anyhow, that night we went, we started early in January. Because of the severe labour shortage, they offered all the students who were coming in and those who were already there to work over the holiday period. So that's what we did. Said, yes, we'll do that. So we went down there and we took over the general duties, because the college, they were short of staff, short of labour, and naturally they made up with the students. And that seemed to be the colour of their whole time at Rosebery. Those 3 years were right in the middle of the war, and we were the mainstay of doing all the work.
So you would have been, what, about 16 or 17 when you started?
Yes, I was 16.
Yeah. Mm. And had you done that sort of work before?
No. I'd come straight from high school, and we were green, believe you me. From a protected life, where you're in the home environment, and your parents, they looked after you. But all of a sudden, we were down there, and that I remember that first day still very clearly, because we started to get to know each other, and then we went to bed that night, and that was quite okay. Next thing, thump, 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 thump. What's this going on? The door flashed open. The next thing, we were down on the deck, and what the hell's going on here? And it turned out the senior students had given us an introduction. So they came up and they tipped us out of bed for a start. Then they grabbed our beds, threw them out the window on the Jock Chambers lawn, and there we were. No beds. Our beds down on the lawn below, and then they let us go and pick them up. So that was our introduction to the senior students. Well, they give us hell after that. For the rest of the, I'd say it was a good 6 months or so, we had a pretty rough trot. And they made liberal use of us and our talents to do personal things for them. But anyhow, we survived.
Was there, when did you start lectures, like straight away or a lot
later? No, we didn't start till normal time. I don't know if that's April or March or April. So we started in January. Well, incidentally, we were working with army rates of pay, which was 5 shillings a day. For those on early work, got 6 shillings a day. So we were just on normal army rates. So we did get paid for our time that we started off in those first couple of months before the actual lectures and that started.
And then after that, you were then just... your work was just normal, as part of being part of a student after that.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you still remember some of the first lectures that you had?
I can picture them, but the old memory is slipping on names. Oh. I remember Schinkel and Kuechel, MacDonald and a few of those, Higginbottom. He's pretty famous, old Hick, yeah. And his family, and Williams, up at the winery. As a matter of fact, Williams was the father of, his daughter married Bob Napstein, who I mentioned to you about the first day there. Bob was in our room, and we shared it together. And he finished up marrying Coral, and they went over to New Zealand, and he only passed away about a year back.
Yeah, so he did the oenology?
He did the oenology, yes. Yeah. And they had the Stanley Wine Company in Clare. That was the family that owned the wine company. But Bob never went back there. He, I think he went with Sepults and then McWilliams Wine and went over to New Zealand to manage their affairs over there.
Can you remember the sort of routine of the lectures and outside work? How was that done?
We did 3 days work, 2 days lecture a week, and then the next week it'll be three lectures and two work. Saturdays we do odd lectures, bookkeeping and those sort of things, on the Saturday morning. It was pretty full on. We never seemed to have spare time, I didn't think.
Yeah. And what, do you have exams a couple of times a year, that sort of thing?
Yes, they were normal. I remember the first exam, we thought, gosh, do we have to do exams? And we all fronted up. I don't think we did too brilliantly. We all improved dramatically after that. But it was the different routine of that environment compared to school. When you're at high school, you did everything you were told to do. What I found with Roseworthy, which is the same as tertiary, is that it's just dished out and you did what you like with it. And so there wasn't, it was all, you had to be self-motivated to do everything. Whereas at high school, that the environment you just came from, you were told to do everything. So it was quite a dramatic change.
Mm. And what the lectures went from what time in the morning, 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock or?
Oh, that's a good question. I think they're a normal 8:30, around about that time. Normal hours.
Yeah, and what was like at night time? Do you have like a study period or just do what you like? Or?
Well, it was up to you to do study if you wanted. Or not. Well, we all had to do a certain amount. I mean, the conditions weren't what you call really comfortable. We had no heating or cooling, and getting through the winter wasn't too brilliant. And it was not easy. I didn't find the college really easy or that comfortable physically.
Mm. Tell about, you said earlier about the food was a bit rough because of the rationing. What about, can you remember some of the, good meals or bad meals? Or?
Well, our cook was Jack Osborne, and he was a football fanatic. And he was the coach, and everything was football to Jack. And it was quite interesting. I found out that the company I was involved with here in Port Pirie was owned by my family, and it was called Moyles. And the Moyles had the business before things went belly up, and we were able to take over the business. But Albie Moyle, he fought in Gallipoli, and this Jack Osborne, who was our cook and the fanatic footballer, he also fought in Gallipoli. And he told me the story of how he found Albie barely wounded, and I don't know if he's hit by a shell, but he said he was in a pretty bad way. And he put him on his shoulder and he carried him back to the first aid station. So virtually saved his life. So I had a connection immediately that I went into the college.
Did it mean you got some good extra food? Or
We got on very well with old Jack. We did our best.
I read in your little story you wrote about this second year's little feast you had one night. Tell us about that, about the sheep that you got and had a barbecue out there.
Oh, did I tell you that story?
Yeah, I read it in your little story you wrote.
Oh, yeah, that was the time that the third years were having their big bash. Yeah, they're sort of leaving farewell, and we were just out in the scrub, and we thought, this is not too fair. We'll go and we'll have our own little party. If they won't let us into theirs, we'll have our own. So the ration flock happened to be between the college and the farm, and so we just snuck down there and we picked out the best, and because our ration flock wasn't too flash, I think the college had a deal with the abattoirs that they'd take all the scrubbers, everything that was rubbish that was left, they'd take it. And anyhow, there was one terrific weather in this group. We'll have that, so we did. We snuck it down the slaughterhouse and we dressed him up and we come back and, what are we going to do? Next thing I know, we hung it in my wardrobe. So, and then we went out next night and out the quarry and we had a nice old party. We thought, that's great, we're square now.
Terrific. So that would have been, what, 1940, end of 1943?
Four.
End of 44. Mm-hmm. So what was it like as a student during the war with all this action happening, you know, across the seas? Was people on edge, or were they worried about the war, or how did
Well, there was always a lot of concern about the war. And we were aware of it. See, there was an Air Force base at Malala. There was one at Gawler, North Gawler. And there, the one at North Gawler, what I understand, that those, they got shot up in Darwin. They'd come back to Gawler and reform and have a spell. But the boys used to hop in the planes and go buzzing around the country. And they used to come over the farms, and they'd come and they'd buzz the farmers out in the paddocks. It was a ridiculous thing when you think about it. So they'd see a horse team, and they'd come and dive bomb it. And we had a situation where Clive Matthews was out harrowing, and he had 8 horse team, and that's a bar of harrows. And one of these aircraft, I think it was a Spitfire, it came straight at him at ground level and zoomed up over the horses. That's how low they were. And the horses all reared. And in doing so, they split the coupling in the centre between the four, so there's four sides. They wheeled around and off. And in doing so, they pulled the harrows back and dropped them right on top of Clive, who was right down in the middle. And they were still attached on the outside. How he wasn't killed, none of us will ever know. But it was a ridiculous thing for them, for the pilot to have done that. And but I think that's all he was trying to do, is to get a team to bolt.
In your little story too, you talked about dances at the Tin Tabernacle and that sort of stuff. Can you remember a few of those nights?
Yeah, they were good. We looked forward to those because it was a break from our routine. And I think they had them there every, I don't know, it was fortnight or month. And they would have them in Roseworthy and Wosley's, occasional in Gawler. So we really enjoyed that because I think the college life tend to be a little bit tedious. You know, it was the same thing over and over again. And you didn't have much spare time because you're either working or studying or lectures or whatever was going on. It was a pretty busy time.
So do they have like a band or a people
yes.
playing the piano or what sort
yeah,
of?
Yeah, they'd have mainly a pianist, and they might have an accordion or a violin. Pretty restricted.
Yeah, so that would go from what, 8 to 11?
8 till 12.
8 till 12,
yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Have a good supper? What was supper?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Now you're talking.
Yeah. I heard one of the other students told me that the first years always had to look after the wallflowers to make sure that their mothers kept coming to bring in supper. So every girl got a dance. Or...
No, I didn't hear that. Yeah. I think they did it automatically.
Yeah. The tin tabernacle is still standing. It's surprising it's been there all that time.
Yes.
So I must go and have a look at it sometime.
I thought the white ants might have got it by now.
Yeah, I saw it a few months ago. It looks like it's still intact.
Yes.
But you're right, it could easily be eaten up.
Of course, a big deal too was our annual ball. We put a lot of effort into the old ball. In the dining room, we used to have it in there, and we'd get down there for months before, scrubbing the floor, polishing it. But just imagine hobnail boots over it all through the year. It's pretty scarred. So we got down and we'd give it the real works, so we had a decent ball.
Yeah, what time of year was that?
Oh, I got an idea. That'd be in the middle of winter, I think.
Yeah.
Would have been.
And where would the girls come from?
All local.
Oh, yeah.
Farms. So, yeah. Mostly local farms, Gawler.
Yeah.
And, you know, that area.
Were the dancers at that time when you were a student, because a lot of people were at the war and stuff, were men in short supply at the dances, or?
Oh, it's not really, because, see, the college made up for quite a deficit. Mm-hmm. See, we had quite a few, so although we only had 40 students, at least half of them would be at the dance. Well, that'd make up for a certain shortage in here.
Mm. Well, what about some other parts of college life? You talked about the senior students giving you a hard time, but what about some of the work you did? You've spoke a bit about the horses before.
Oh, now the horses, that was a sort of a sad story to me, because when I started there, we had, I think it was about 125 working horses, and of course we got to know them all pretty well, because we had to groom and feed them every day, and they become part of our life really, and you got to know them each by their name and that. And I remember at the end, when the college bought a tractor, said, "Well, we don't need these horses anymore." And they shot a good number of them. And I think they went to the knackery. That was pretty sore. That was right at the end of my period at the college. Mm. And I think there was a lot of people who have, you know, felt rather sad about all of that.
So that was the same, like all the other farms were getting tractors then too, were they?
Same thing.
Yeah. So it was only because of the war, shortage of fuel, that you couldn't have a tractor in the early 40s.
Well, that would be one thing, yeah. But it was traditionally horses right up till then. So really the war finished the horses, and then it was just mob of tractors after the war, and fuel was a bit better supply, but it took quite a while before we got full fuel supply.
One of the stories you told me earlier on was about that colt that the vet was doing an operation on, which didn't make it. Well, give us a few more details.
I don't know whether it was partly my fault or not, but I took instructions. I did what he told me. So I was given the anaesthetic. So I was on the up on the head end, and I had the contraption around the snout, and I was pouring in the anaesthetic. I think it was chloroform we used. But anyhow, the vet, he was up the front, he was down the back end, I was up the front, and he'd say, "Another ounce." So, boink. And I kept on adding these ounces. Finally, things went quiet and still. He said, "I think it's had it."
Oh dear.
And sure enough, poor colt was dead.
Oh, right. That's a bit sad. So you came from some Port Pirie, so you learnt to learn to handle horses and drive teams and stuff. So that would be a big learning curve for you.
Yeah. Well, actually, two doors from us, where I lived, where I was living in Port Pirie, there was a butcher shop there, and the butcher had horses he used for delivery, and there was one there they used to ride. And he said, "You can have it any time you like." And I used to use it a lot. I'd ride up and down to the street. I think in those days I didn't have a bike. Well, not many did either. And I'd go for rides out in the country. I thought that was great, a lot better than walking. So that when I went to Roseworthy, I finished up getting myself a horse, and I bought that over in Laura, and then I rode it from Laura down to Roseworthy. Took me 4 days to get there. that was a trip and a half, but it was very handy for getting around the district down there.
So when was it? Where did you keep it when it was at Roseworthy?
Straight you go straight out the front door and just to the right, behind there was the golf course that went around that road coming in along that road, and we kept it in there.
That's just next to the oval.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, right. That's right. Mm.
Oh, right, so you didn't have to pay anything for it? Just kept it?
No, yeah. They let me keep it there.
Yeah. Do you have to feed it with chaff and stuff as well? Or?
No, we give it a sheaf of hay every now and again.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, it's pretty cheap sort of transport.
Yeah. I was made it a little bit easier for getting around.
Yeah. Can you remember some of the other... students, you talked about Knapstein. Was Rex Krause there or...
Yes.
Bruce Eastick?
He was in the third year.
Oh, yeah.
Rex. And they're good guys there, second and third years. They give us a pretty hard time because coming from a pretty sedate life, which is going to a normal high school, it's pretty sedate. When you get in there... And the thing is that we found strange, the lecturers never interfered at all. They just stood and watched it all happening. We could make comments about that.
Mm-hmm. And whereabouts was the accommodation? Was that only in the corridor and the main building where you were?
That's all, yes.
And that other building that was built after the war, red brick building?
See, there was only 40 of us there. Mm-hmm. And... I don't know, the main building held that, probably half them, corridor the other half. That's all that was.
Yeah.
So it was there.
So the main building only had first years, and the seniors were in the
correct
in the corridor.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we were there on our own. We'd get our regular visits from the seniors, with their bags of boots and or boxes of boots and things to do. Jobs to do. I remember the night, particularly the night of the initiation. That was in the old. It was sort of the main room as you go in the front door on the right. It was sort of a gathering room, and they had it in there. That'd be the most uncomfortable night of my life. It was in the middle of winter.
Mm-hmm.
And oh my goodness, I'll never forget that.
So it says like 20 first years a part of this stuff.
20 first years, 8 third years, and 12 second years, roughly, I think. That was about 40.
Yeah, so was this after the steeplechase or before?
Oh, been pretty close in that era. It wasn't day one or that week. Yeah. It was about 2-3 months later.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's, we've been rounded up all the time. You know, they just get out and a couple of them get outside the corridor, yell out, first years. And, of course, the last one always got a couple of boxes of boots to do. And so we'd all... You'd hear this rumble, rumble, rumble. Everyone and line up and count. The last one, he copped it every time.
Was that the same person or just...
Oh, no.
Just like of who got out first.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Who was heard best or who was closest.
In your little story you wrote, you talked about doing a lot of secretary stuff for the sports teams.
Mm.
You were organising some of the matches and stuff.
Well, yes, we did all through my time there. See, there was no normal association play anywhere in anything. So everything had to be made up. And I was involved in the cricket and the football. And we'd play against scratch teams from the district and against the Air Force Base in Malala, and then like the police barracks, university, people all over. You know, anywhere we get a team together, we would play either football or cricket.
So how would you make contact with them? I mean, no phones, was there?
No, we'd write. We'd write to them or see them personally, drop in on them. And we used to have some wonderful times, so we're pretty willing matches.
So the was the old pool, that was still pretty active in those days, in the old dam?
That was the old dirt dam.
Yeah.
Shocking that was. Against the muddiest water I've seen in my life.
Well, I was still using it in 1968. It was still around.
Were they?
Yeah.
Did they put a pool in there?
Yeah, not until the 80s.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was... Matter of fact, we were talking about Bob Napstein earlier. I don't think Bob could swim. And he... I don't know how it happened, but how Bob went in off the diving board and he went down and so I said, "Where's Bob? He hasn't come up." And we looked around, gosh, there, what do we do now? So I dived in and I found him. He was under the springboard on the bottom of the pool. And I heaved him out and I... evacuated him, got rid of the stuff, pumped him out and that, and he was a lucky boy.
Oh, so how deep was it there?
Oh, it'd be a couple of metres. Under the diving board, it was two or three metres.
I've never seen it empty. I mean, you can't see the bottom because it's always murky. But
it was, in those days, it was very murky.
Yeah.
Well, it was worse than murky. You'd had to look the difference between the pool and the ground.
All right. So you didn't? Did you swim there very often, or?
Yes, in the summer. Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose it's cool at least.
Oh yeah, that's the only thing is it was wet.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we went out there quite a bit then.
Yeah.
Because there was no things like air conditioning or even fans. There was nothing. You just took things as they were.
And how often would you come home?
Very rarely, because when I came home, we'd have to hop on the truck, go into Roseworthy, wait for the train, hop on the train, go to Salisbury, wait 4 hours, catch the train to Port Pirie, and then we'd have a few hours home, turn around and go back again. So it wasn't a very fruitful sort of voyage.
Well, the train would have been pretty active during the war, wouldn't it, with troop movements and things?
Well, you know, that honestly, I've got, at Salisbury, the train's pulled up, and I've gone to get in the door, and you couldn't get in. It was jam-packed, people standing up. And I've even pushed my case in one door and gone out of the next door and crept in there and finally made my way up to pick my case up. It was that jam-packed tight. It was mainly Air Force, Army, but mainly Air Force coming to Port Pirie, because Port Pirie had an Air Force base. We had a couple of thousand out here, and they were always going up and down on the train.
Mm. Was the air base, is that where the airport is now, or is it somewhere?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And what's more, we're making a little claim there. I spent a lot of time at the airport and... Yeah, with our flying group out there. During the war, the base never lost one day flying through weather in the 5 years of the war.
That's a good place to have it, then.
That's a world record that no one will beat.
Yeah.
So it gives a testimony to what sort of climate we have here.
Yeah.
And I've never had a day that I couldn't take off or land at that airport.
Mm. Even the wind's not never been that bad.
No.
Oh, terrific. Mm. So with these returned soldiers, were any of those at the college when you were there? Because they started trickling back.
Yes, they started. They just started coming back. Yeah, I shared with one, Wesley Smith. He'd just come back, and he and I shared a room. Oh, when I'd finished at the course, the diploma, the intention was for me then to go to New South Wales. to the college there.
To Hawkesbury.
Hawkesbury, and do the daring course. They had, they're the only ones that had the daring course. But everything was chock-a-block with return soldiers were coming back. So that was off. So what I finished up doing, I had 6 months there with McDonald, who was the dairy instructor. And I stayed there and I copied all his notes that he ever made and worked in the factory and got some experience there and did me tickets and all of that sort of thing. And I had 6 months of that, and then I came straight here, straight into the factory here.
All right.
And things were that good in those days that my father said to me, see, it was a family business. It was my father, and it was four of them, partners in the business. And he said, things are pretty tough. And he said, what about you just working for your keep for the first year? And that's what I did. I worked there up to 100 hours a week in the butter factory, and I did that just for my keep. Mm. I didn't get a set of pay for the first 12 months. Now, who'd do that today?
Yeah. So what was the, this is the start of your working career, what happened after that?
Oh, actually, we had a very interesting career. I stayed there for about 3 or 4 years. We were running the dairy factory. And my father, he was right up with things, said there's no future in this. And we woke up that, so he'd inherited that business, but anyhow, all in the local farms here, you think, well, they're trying to produce milk. And this is not milk-producing country. We're outside the Gorders line, low rainfall, very little grass, very hard to produce milk in this area. So one day, hopped in the car and went across to Laura to see Jack Boker, who ran Golden North, who were our opposition, and put a proposition to him. Said, Jack, what say you take over all our business and we'll come to a deal? And Jack was delighted. And boom, that's it. But then I stayed on for 12 months with Golden North and got them all up and running. Because I was the only one who had the tickets, and, you know, your boiler attendant tickets, your milk and cream graders testing and tickets and all of that sort of thing. And so they expanded, and we're expanding on the soft drink side of things. That went on for several years, and then they got their own premises. Because they were running out of room. We were running out of room, so it suited us both. And then they went on from strength to strength, and they've done extremely well.
So this is after the war?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is like, you talk about late 40s or early 40s? Or
Late 40s and into the 50s.
Yeah. In your story, you talked about you were at the college towards the end of the war, so was there any pressure on you to enlist and join the Air Force or Army?
Callaghan, who was the principal, I don't know if I mentioned that he was on the war board with Sturtevant, Hicks and all the top boys in Australia, that they were on this war board. And he lined us up and said, forget any idea of going away to the war. He said, your work is much more important here for primary production than going there and putting your head on the line.
Yeah.
And he said, as far as at that stage, this is going back a couple of years before the end of the war, he said, the war is as good as over. So the powers that be knew that we were on top and we were going to win, which is exactly, it came as they predicted.
Mm.
But he would have a bar of us going away.
Mm.
And you got that general feeling the whole thing was running down. You know, they were driving them back in Europe and Asia and Pacific and all that.
Yeah.
There was a real turn around and they were gathering momentum. And that's when we were given the choice. He said, don't you dare.
Sure. And so how did these returned soldiers, they would have been taking any initiation or any stuff from the... senior.
Oh, no, no.
So how did they handle that?
Well, they were all previous students. So they're only carrying on.
Oh, so it wasn't new ones, they were just finishing off.
Oh, no doubt they did come in after I left.
Yeah.
There could have been those returned servicemen. I never really found out, or even inquired for that matter.
You can imagine someone who's just been through hell and high water overseas is not going to put up with being tipped out of bed.
Oh, no. They wouldn't be game.
So let's just get back to the dairy factory was sold in the family, then you expanded into your soft drink business. So where did that go after that?
Well, that was in the 50s. And then 1959 was just a very big stroke of luck that somehow we got talking to Coca-Cola. And I said, we'll be thinking about you sometime. Apparently our reputation must have been favourable. And they then offered us to go in partnership for a Coca-Cola franchise here in Piri. And we thought, gee, that sounds all right. So we started that. And then that was 1960. And then a few years later, I started to learn to fly. And in flying, I found a change of attitude to my life. I thought, gosh, up here you can do anything. You can go anywhere and be anywhere, anytime, anyhow. And it really changed my way of thinking. And we started the franchise, and we were going very well. And we got to spread out. We had a factory here in Port Pirie, one in Whyalla. Then we said, we'll go down and put a warehouse in Sejuna, one down Port Lincoln. And they were going well, and of course with the plane you can be anywhere in the wink of an eye, really. So I went in, said, I had a look at Alice Springs, said, well, we'll go up there and we'll start up there. And everyone thought I was off my head. Then we got that up and running and was going extremely well, so we then extended up to Tennant Creek. And finished up from here in Port Pirie, our territory was 2 million square kilometres, or a quarter of Australia, was done out of here. It was all the fact that I knew that I could be anywhere there tomorrow.
Right. Is this Coca-Cola or Moyles as well? Or
yes.
Just Coke?
No, we did it with Moyles as well.
Oh, yeah. So I often wonder, I know that in the old days every major town had their own soft drink factory.
That's right.
Where'd you get your water from?
We got it from Beedaloo originally, but that's one thing with Coca-Cola, they would be the world's top experts in water purification, because they got thousands of plants throughout the world, and every one of them would not have the same water as anyone else. So they had to say, how do you treat this product? And they are world experts in water treatment. So we just follow along.
Because South Australian water has always been regarded as being fairly hard.
Yes.
So you compared water from Apple and Tablelands, or we're getting lovely fresh water from the sky all the time. Mm.
Well, then you can imagine with Coke in a couple hundred countries in the world.
Yeah.
They get everything. It doesn't matter what. You can give them sewerage, seawater, anything, and they can convert it back to the product that's required for their product.
Mm, terrific.
Yeah, and it's all standardised. It doesn't matter what you start with there, it finishes there the same. They're all the same. And you could take any water, I'd say, that they produce out of a Coke plant in the world, and you wouldn't be able to tell where it comes from, because it's all standardised to the one thing.
Mm. That's terrific. So since in your working life, did you have anything to do with Roseby after you left?
I'd go to an occasional reunion, not as often as I would have liked. I used to always go when it was at the showgrounds, and that's going back years ago.
That's like the Mid-North reunion, was it?
No, the state one.
At the show. Oh, sorry, you mean in Adelaide? Yeah.
The Raw Show.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but they used to meet down there. And then they spread around, and as I said, I had a pretty solid work detail, and I didn't have the freedom of time over many years that I wished I could have had.
Mm. Well, so when you go back to college, can you remember as it was, or does it get confused by all the new buildings and the change of?
Wouldn't know it now.
Yeah, looks. You look at the aerial photographs, often you think, well, those things were there, but the rest is all new.
I'd say most of it's new.
Yeah.
Yeah, from, yeah, and I go there, I don't know this.
Yeah.
And but it was a very significant part of my life, and it made you look after yourself, and you know, you think your own way out of things. No, I thought it was a tremendous education.
Yeah.
One of my best, I would say, decisions.
Oh, terrific. Okay, well, look, Brian, we might wind it up there. It's been great talking to you and hearing your stories and reminiscences from that long time ago. So we'll wind it there. So thanks very much for this opportunity, and people look forward to listening to you on the Roka website. Your interview will be up there sometime, and they can share your memories.
Oh, well, thank you very much for the opportunity. I had no idea this had ever happened. So at my age, I'm running out of puffer, which is something that is very annoying. You know what you could do, you know that you can't do it anymore, and you're battling.
Oh, okay. All right, well, we'll leave it there.
Yeah.
Bye.